Waiting for the seminar from Macmillan because it's great. I have no doubts about the seminar conducted by Macmillan.
The seminar is also was that teach us how to conduct the activity as well. So we also have kind of new activities here.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Season 2 of the ELT Upgraders podcast with myself, JC. In Season 2, we're going to be jumping around from country to country, exploring Asia, boosting our knowledge of the region in terms of education systems, what's going on in terms of latest ELT trends. We're going to be hearing from a whole range of teachers, educators, what's going on in their context in terms of teacher challenges and potential solutions. So without further ado, let's jump in and see where we are exploring today. All right, so in this podcast, we are going to visit wonderful Indonesia. And I say visit, but actually we've been there recently, and on the line we have Dr. Del. Hi, Del.
Hello.
And we've been there. Yeah, pretty good, mate. And we've been in Indonesia recently, right? What was going on in Indonesia? Where have we been and what we were doing?
We started in Jakarta, and we had a Macmillan Day at the Santika Hotel in Jakarta. Then we moved on to sort of Bahia, had a similar Macmillan Day at the same hotel in Surabaya as well. Yeah, it was great. Really, really positive. Loads of people came. How many did we have in Jakarta? About 250?
250, and I think it's something similar in Surabaya, and we had a range of sessions going on, and we had a chance to... We had a little doctor's clinic as well, so we had a chance to chat to a lot of the teachers, find out their challenges in the classrooms as well, and we'll come back.
That was a real win-win, wasn't it? I think they really responded well to having a one-on-one session to talk to somebody, and we obviously got a lot of information about the challenges that are going on and the kind of things that teachers need help with.
Absolutely, and I was just struck by, you know, the passion that the teachers have for teaching in Indonesia, even though, you know, that felt, you know, quite unconfident with their English. They were a little bit inexperienced as well. They were so keen to develop and get new ideas. They were hungry, and it was absolute pleasure, wasn't it? I think working with them.
It really is. It really does motivate you to and make you, you know, energize as well. You know, it feels great to be in a room with most of the people there just really, really happy with what they're doing and loving their jobs. It's really great.
Brilliant, brilliant. And you were doing some sessions on error correction as well, which we're going to pick up in this podcast today. So what we're going to do, we're going to have a quick listen in a minute to some Indonesian teachers talking about error correction, how they correct errors in the classroom. We'll have a follow-up discussion as well. We'll have a chat. We've got a few questions, or actually questions that a lot of teachers raise in Indonesia about error correction. So we'll pick up on some of those and discuss in more detail. And then most importantly, we have the matter of the Upgraders Country Quiz, Indonesia Special, where you take on Rika and Nifa from the Innovative Learning Centre there in Surabaya. Remember that one?
I do remember that very well.
All right. Without further ado then, let's listen to Rika and Nifa talking about error correction.
Actually, in our class, we used to have the error recognition in every session of the class. So, for example, like in a day, every time, like, for example, after one activity, we always like to highlight one sentence or two sentences on the board, and then we try to encourage the students to, let's see, and then have, how can you revise this? So, it's like the error recognition for every class since they are very, very young.
Okay.
So based on what they say in the activities, for example, like in the speaking one, for example, they are having this conversation and then the sentence, and then this is wrong, okay, I'm going to write it down on the board, and then they need to know which one is wrong, which one is not.
Okay.
So it's a very beginning.
Yeah.
So you try and get them to...
get used to.
Work out the errors themselves first,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then we are writing. For example, if it is speaking, I mean speaking skills, so... For example, the students like saying, "I'm is happy, Miss. I'm is happy." And then, oh, I hear someone that saying, "I'm is happy." And then directly, I wrote it in the whiteboard. And yeah, after the activity, we are discussing together. So, do you think that it's correct or not?
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, no, Miss. Some of the students will say no. Some of the students, yes, Miss, it's correct. And then, yeah. Oh, this is. It's not the correct one, and then this is how do we say it, because we don't need is anymore if you use it's like that.
That's good. How old are these students? What level are they?
Actually, in our course in Innovative Learning Center, we teach like from the kindergarten until adults. So actually from the very beginning,
maybe
starter,
3 years old, yeah.
So for example, if it's a starter, they only say, okay, what is this? This is a blah blah blah, this is a blah blah blah. We only emphasize on this is a and this is an. But somehow when they are in the pre-beginner, for example, when they have like 4 longer sentences, they get used to, for example, like, okay, if you have like this sentence, we start to recognize, like, we have to introduce them that this is not correct, and then we have to revise it. So basically it's like for all levels.
But you have different strategies at different levels, right?
Yeah, of course.
Any strategies that you saw today that you want to use?
Of course. We will use all of these.
We have known about the finger stuff, and
then
we have known about the buzz.
We got
course.
The seminar as well, the same seminar from our
previous mentor.
And then, yeah, your presentation is, I think, is more interesting because we also can, what's that? Practice as well. So yeah, the fingers,
I like the doobie the mister.
Yeah, that one. And then the cheering and the
cheering and booing.
That's why. Why not? Nice. I think for teenagers as well, because they like, ooh, like when their friends make mistake, they like booing someone, right?
Perfect. Yeah, yeah. But I think next time we can invite these ladies and come and do some workshops as well.
Yes.
Yeah,
some local,
so much.
Local presenters will be fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Great. Well, thanks for your time on that one.
My pleasure, mister.
All right, Dil. So that was Rika and Nifa. Interesting chat there. Some great ideas. What do we take from what they were saying about error correction?
I was actually surprised that they have a systematic approach in their school to error correction. It seems like they have time set aside in every lesson, which is focused on error correction. I mean, most places I've worked, teachers sort of do error correction in their own way. There's not really a plan, but they seem to have factored this into their curriculum and their syllabus, which was really interesting and actually very, very positive.
It's great, wasn't it, how they were saying, even from the, you know, the lowest students, I think it was even the kindergarten level, they were integrating little aspects of corrective feedback. It's kind of like building up a culture, right, of correcting feedback in a positive way, I guess.
I think it's super important. Yeah, they said from kindergarten to adults, they use different strategies at different levels. But it's super important because it shows that people, it shows from an early age how you can learn from your mistakes, how it's a positive thing, rather than glossing over errors and actually showing them what they can do with their mistakes. Really, really super. I was really impressed.
And they like those doobie-doo and cheering and booing activities, which we're going to pick up on a little bit later, right?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they like they like them, and they said they're already incorporating the stuff that we presented to them, which was really good as well.
And they like your session as well. They said they had workshops on error correction before, but yours was more appealing, they said.
I was sat next to them though, so
they had to say that. Good. All right, so we've got a few questions from some of the Indonesian teachers about error correction. So shall we fire away on some of those?
Yeah.
All right. So the first question was, what's the difference between an error, a mistake, and a slip?
Right. Well, my understanding, and I think this is the general consensus, is that an error, it's weird actually describing, because you want to use the word mistake when you're describing what an error is. But anyway, an error is caused by a lack of knowledge. So the student doesn't actually know what language they're supposed to use, or they don't have the correct communication strategies to be able to communicate effectively. So it's a lack of knowledge, linguistic, communicative. A mistake is a lack of, or a mistake is an error that's made even though the student's got the ability. So it might be something along the lines of the third person singular missing off the S that they know should be there, and they just forget to do it, and they can usually correct themselves. Whereas an error, they wouldn't be able to correct themselves because they don't have the language yet.
Okay.
I'm rambling a bit here, but and a slip is just a silly mistake made by tiredness, inattentiveness. Lots of native speakers make slips, and I think if you analyse this podcast, you'll find lots of slips that we make with the language just because we're thinking about something else. They can be ignored.
Okay then. So yeah, so using those definitions then, so what should we be correcting in class? So where to start, I guess?
Well, my feeling is obviously errors and mistakes need to be corrected. Slips, I would just forget about slips. The only way you can use slips really is in actually is to like build rapport, because slips can be quite amusing. And I'll give you an example of a slip. Where I was teaching in Thailand, a group of pre-intermediate students, and they were talking, I think it was either rooms in the house, or I can't remember whether it's rooms in the house or food, but one guy said that he'd spent some time in the chicken, meaning he'd spent some time in the kitchen.
Okay.
Now, this is a very common mistake in a slip. And in fact, I heard Ricky Gervais on a podcast use the word chicken instead of kitchen, which is really funny. And it's just recently, and obviously he was thinking about something else. It was, but we went back to this chicken kitchen thing throughout the course just to have a bit of fun and a laugh, and it was really nice. But on the whole, slips can be ignored. Errors and mistakes, they obviously need to be addressed, and depending on when they're made and what errors or mistakes are made, depends on when you correct them. So, if you were to make an error, for example, I think if it's a fluency activity, then you would let it go and correct it at the end. If it was an accuracy based activity where you were doing some drilling or something like that, then you would correct it immediately. A mistake, you would get the student to try and correct themselves, and again, depending on if it was an accuracy or fluency activity.
Okay. So if it was, say, for example, an accuracy activity, and then you hear a mistake or an error, what strategies could we use then to go about correcting those spoken errors in class?
Right. So if it's an error, so if I know the student hasn't got the ability to correct themselves because they don't have the linguistic ability or the communication strategy to actually correct themselves, then I would need to decide whether I could get another student to model it and correct them, or whether I would just correct it myself and do some teacher correction. And I would also need to It's an inquiry-based activity. I'd need to pick a strategy that I know would be effective for the student. So a lot of error correction is based on your students and what they like, what their needs are. Some students would be happy to be corrected immediately and by the teacher. Others might prefer for their peer to correct them if the peer can. And then you also have to consider building the self-esteem of the peer. If the peer's correcting their friends, then that's really good and motivating for learners as mm-hmm. well.
So you had some different, very cool strategies for correcting errors for maybe sort of fluency-based ones, which you come back to mm-hmm. after. But also you had some ones for in the moment. So when they made a mistake or an error, you're doing some singing or something. Was it the Doobie-Doo? Was that when they made an error and you give them immediate feedback? Was that right?
Yeah.
What was that all
yeah,
about?
So that's mainly raising awareness of an error. So if you're doing some prawn, for example, you can raise awareness of the student's made an error. Not by pointing out what the error is, but by getting them to think about it. So that would actually possibly be more of a mistake because you would assume they have the ability. So, and you would sing or hum a tune or a Frank Sinatra when we looked out, which was The Strangers in the Night, doobie doobie doo. So if the student makes a mistake, you doobie doobie doo, they realize they've made a pronunciation mistake and they can think about it and then hopefully correct themselves. Or that awareness that they've received that awareness immediately so they can correct themselves in their mind not to make that mistake again in the future.
Nice. All right. Yeah. And then also then you had some activities you were doing, some booing and cheering, which could be used maybe to correct fluency-based activities after they finish the activity, right? So what was that activity all about, the booing and cheering?
So the booing and the cheering is basically what you need to do is board utterances that students have made during a fluency activity. So you'll be walking around monitoring them and writing either on your pad or I like to use strips of A3 paper and write the sentences nice and big on the A3 paper. And then, wandering around, you've got a list of all these nice sentences and sentences where they've made mistakes. And you put these on the board, and you go down them. And every time you read a sentence or you point to the sentence, and if the sentence is correct, all the students cheer. And if the sentence is incorrect, then they boo. Okay, and you get down to the end, and you put a cross next to the ones that they booed. Once that's been done, you can take away the correct sentence. So you focus then on the mistakes, and then you go through the sentence of each word, and they cheer the word, and then they boo the incorrect word, and then you correct it.
Nice.
So you're now breaking down each word. So you're booed all the sentences, or cheered all the sentences, and now they're cheering every single word until the mistake, and they boo.
Great. So it's kind of
nice.
Yeah, it's a very sort of engaging, sort of fun way for students to correct errors. And I guess they don't, or probably do know which error they made on the board, but it's not kind of, oh, that individual made a mistake. It's kind of a group effort as well.
Exactly. And again, you will know your students, so you can, I've done this before where I've pointed out to students that it's their mistake, because I know they're comfortable being pointed, actually, they want to know what mistakes they're making. So with this, it could be anonymous, but like you said, you know in your heart of heart you made that mistake. But you also need to know as a teacher that which student really wants to be pointed out what mistakes they have individually made so that they can make a record themselves.
Great, fantastic. And you've got lots
and,
more...
And a way,
go on, sorry.
And a way of doing that, of knowing, you can ask your students when or if they want to be corrected. So I didn't mention this in actually the presentation, but there's a thing called traffic lights. So you give out a card at the start of the course, when you want to focus on error correction, and they put a green, and they have a green, a red, and an amber. So green means correct me all the time. Whenever you feel it's necessary, please correct me. Red means I've had a busy day. Leave me alone, and I'll be all right. Just for today, leave me alone. I don't want to be corrected today. And amber means correct me if you think you need to be. But if you don't think I need to be corrected, then don't. It's up to you, kind of thing, as a teacher. So it just gives you an indication and passes responsibility to the learner a little bit on when they want to be corrected.
Nice. So each individual in class has a set of traffic lights? Is that right?
Or? Yeah. So they can just put it on the desk next to them or stick it on their chair or wherever, somewhere that where you can see it, and you know then when to correct or when not to correct, or who to correct.
That's an interesting one, especially if you're maybe teaching adults or older teens on a weekday after work or after school, right? And they come in with different attitudes. And I remember a lot of my adults, they really, you know, wanted to be corrected every single thing. And then me personally, I don't. I hate it. I like maybe to come back to it, you know, later on at the end of class. But if I'm sort of speaking with my teacher and they keep correcting everything, it's so demoralising and demotivating.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, good. All right, and you've got lots more ideas as well on correcting spoken errors on your new blog post as well.
Yeah.
Which is available on our Macmillan EducationAsia.com website. So teachers.
Yeah, all those strategies that we looked at in the Macmillan days and a few more, you can find examples of there.
Great. All right then. So should we jump across? I've got some other questions from teachers about written errors. Should we jump in and have a look at where to start with written errors?
Sure. So written errors, obviously, I think are much easier to correct because you have them right there in front of you. You can see them. You're not sort of picking up on them. Often correcting, you might not even hear the error if it's a spoken error. You might not even catch it. You know, you might think it's so. You have to decide whether it's a mistake or a slip. There's all sorts of things to consider when you're correcting spoken errors. Written errors, they're there. You can see them. One thing you have to be careful with written errors, similar to what you were saying about being corrected all the time, is if you get a piece of work back and it's covered in red ink, then it's very demotivating. So students don't want to see that. However, they do need to know that they've made mistakes. So a way of doing it is using, obviously, the writing codes. So you put, instead of actually crossing out the mistake traditionally and then writing the correction above it, you just write a symbol or give them some indication. So if it's the wrong tense, you just write WT next to it. And then they have to go away and correct their mistake. So spelling would obviously be an S, the wrong form, WF, missing word, NW, this kind of thing. And you can come up with your own indications, but there are websites out there that have got these writing codes on them that you can look at. And again, if you have a look at the blog, I've put one in the blog for people to access as well. The problem with using writing codes or error codes is that if you've got a class of 30 students, for example, not uncommon, and you give them some writing to do, then you've got 30 pieces of writing to mark. So if you mark it, you mark them all once, you're done, you give it back to the students. But if you're giving it back to them with writing codes on, then you're then expecting them to correct their own errors, then you get it back again. You've got to mark it twice, so you basically double your workload. It's a really nice thing to do, and students get a lot from it, and they can see their own mistake, they can then make a record of their own mistake, but it does make the work twice as much. So you have to be conscious of when you're going to do it. I wouldn't do it every time, but certainly now and then.
Yeah, absolutely. And would you communicate the writing code to the students?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I'll give them an example first, and we might even go to... There's a, like I said, the website I think it's a British Council website has got a really nice example. And what you can do is go through, do that with the students first, so they get an idea of what's happening. Because it would be very confusing if you just gave it back without any indication of what the codes mean. They can see that very clearly. The other thing actually to consider as well is, say if me and you were teaching a class, we were sharing a class, we have to agree as teachers what the symbols mean. Because if you're using one code and I'm using another code, that'd be very confusing for students.
Yeah. So if you're working in a private language school where you've got lots of teachers, it would be good maybe to get together, even have a workshop on error correction,
yeah,
and kind of agree on a standardised coding, I guess, between you.
Yeah. Mm. And the good thing actually about that, and I guess what thinking you've got, sorry, a little bit further down the line, is if you do that in a private language school, is to kind of come up, maybe even have a mistake board or an error board in the classroom where you can write down common mistakes that students are making. So you build up a really good knowledge of how the local language affects the language that you're teaching, so English is what you're teaching. So you get to see the same mistakes over and over again, and then you can start preempting the mistakes rather than sort of reacting to them. That's a really nice idea.
That's a great idea, actually, because the final question that we got from some teachers was, any tips for correcting L1 interference in writing? So, like you said, some kind of poster board up in the classroom with some common
yeah,
errors that occur as a result of L1 interference would be one idea, maybe.
There's a book. I can't remember the name of the book now. I'm going to have to look this up. But and there's lots of one of the things I was doing when I was preparing for this workshop in Indonesia. I looked online just for common errors that Indonesian students make in English. Got a whole list of stuff. So there's also websites out there that can show you. So I guess teachers, as they become more experienced, get to know what the kind of mistakes their students are making. But I worked in Thailand a long time, and I didn't really talk. Teachers come along, but I guess even when they first arrive in country, they should be given some induction on the kind of errors students make, and some list that would be really useful for them.
Yeah, definitely, some kind of induction training. I remember when I used to work in Vietnam, yeah, we had a session on that, I think. We had a session on Vietnamese culture, but also maybe the language, and raised our awareness of the types of errors in pronunciation, maybe in grammar, that we might be facing when we come to teaching. And I guess what Rika and Nifa said as well is that we could do something similar by writing some common mistakes that they make of L1 interference on the board, get the students to correct it themselves. I wonder if they could do some kind of translation as well, where they would write down a grammatical sentence in, say, Bahasa Indonesian, and then students have to translate it into English or something like that as well. When you have a monolingual class, maybe that could work.
Yeah, it's really a monolingual class is obviously ideal for things like error correction. If you've got a multilingual class, then the error correction has to be really on form, because you're dealing with all sorts of different things that are happening. But yeah, in a monolingual class, quite simple, I think, to do that. I think one thing we haven't spoken about is the responsibility of students as well, and making them aware that they should be recording their errors. Obviously, with spoken errors, that's a bit more difficult to do. And as a teacher, it takes quite a bit of work to record those spoken errors, particularly in the moment. But if with any mistakes with writing, they can actually be making a note of these errors, keeping them a record or a log at the back of their notebook, and it's sort of analysing why they're making that error. Is it because of L1? Is it because they just didn't have the language at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So as we mentioned, we've got all these great ideas on your blog post. Again, that can be found on the Macmillan Education Asia website. That'll also be coming at you through different social media channels. Thanks very much, Del, for your input there. I think you'll be
Thank
doing
you.
some more work in error correction in Vietnam later in the year, right? I think at the VUS TESOL.
Yeah, I'm presenting at VUS TESOL, so I'll be looking at, in this session, looking mainly at a bit of theory around, which we haven't really discussed, but there's a bit of theory around error correction, whether it actually should be done or not. I think generally it's agreed that it does help students acquire the language. So we'll look at a little bit of that. Then we'll look at common Vietnamese mistakes and then some practical techniques on how to correct them.
Brilliant. We'll look forward to that one. All right then, well thanks Del, and it just leaves us now to transition nicely to the Upgraders Country Quiz, where you do indeed take on Rika and Nifa from the Innovative Learning Centre in a general quiz about Indonesia. So, should we have a listen to that? It's rather fun.
Yeah. All right.
Now, for this quiz, you're up against Dr. Del here, all right? So it'll be two against one.
Okay.
I've got a little quiz about Indonesia, general facts.
Oh, my.
Two against one.
Oh, Jesus.
Two Indonesians against one.
I'm not good at general knowledge. Oh, my.
Okay. We must win.
Excuses already.
Okay. So I'm going to give you some numbers. Okay, you have to try and work out how these numbers are connected to Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it may be, for example, population or something like that. Okay, I'll go through all of the questions first. Mm-hmm. Okay, you can note down your answers. Mm-hmm. When I've finished, We'll listen to both your answers and score you as we go.
Okay.
All right. Don't let Del see what you're writing. Okay.
Huh, no.
No, I don't.
You can't
see what I'm writing.
No.
Okay. Number one. So the first number is 72. How do you think the number 72 is connected to Indonesia? You two can work together, actually, if you want to check. Don't tell Del. We can confer later, all right? Number two is 17,000. 17,000, or approximately 17,000. What might that be? No looking at Del.
This one?
Yes.
Okay,
perfect. The same.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Number three. 261.1. 261.1. What might that be?
What is that?
Oh, maybe this one. Maybe this one is... Maybe?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
All right. Number four.
I don't know.
1.58.
1.58. What is that? Oh my God. We are not Indonesian, I think.
1.58.
So I'll give you a choice. Do you want a choice for that one?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Is it the average height of females?
Oh my God.
In meters. Is it the average height of men?
Uh-huh.
You can choose between that.
I don't know. Let me count.
Looking on your phone.
Wait for this.
Okay. This
next one, number five. First, or it's like number one. This one, I say first. Indonesia is first in the world for something. First something. Some serious conferring going on over there.
Yeah.
Can you understand Bahasa, Del?
Yes, of course.
Well, I mean, I don't know. In what sector, in what topic, in what... I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. Don't ask me.
Okay.
Okay.
Next one. The next one is the number 8, and I'm going to give you a multiple choice. Okay, multiple choice. So in Indonesia, there are 8 active volcanoes. There are 8 World Heritage sites, or there are 8 main island land masses. So 8 active volcanoes.
For me, this one.
8 World Heritage sites, or 8 sort of main land mass islands.
Yeah.
And the last one, 5,120.
Really?
5,120. What might that be?
Oh my gosh.
I don't know.
Okay.
Leave it blank for now. Okay. Good. All right then. Let's have a quick look and see how you did against Dr. Dell. So, 72 years.
It's Indonesian age.
Indonesian age.
Independence. I mean, from after Independence Day.
I've got Independence.
From yeah, after Independence Day.
Okay. Very good. So one. Dell, what did you have for 17? Well, approximately 17,000
languages. You're going dialects.
For, you're going for languages?
Yeah.
Islands.
The answer is...
Islands.
Islands on that one.
I crossed it out.
There are a lot of... Actually,
you crossed it out?
I crossed islands out.
Okay, so 2-1 to the locals.
Okay.
What about 261.1?
Languages.
Maybe. You're going for languages?
Yeah.
I don't have any idea.
Yeah, I went for... I got no idea, to be honest. But I thought it can't be 0.1 languages. That was why I was one of a language.
The population rate?
No, increasing.
The population?
I don't think so.
Every year? No, I don't have any idea.
I was a little bit naughty there. I left off the word million.
It's a population, right?
Well, I think we'll give you one each for that one. So 3-2. All right.
I wrote population.
What about 1.58 meters? Average height for females or males?
Female. Women, yeah.
Female.
It's actually men.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, 1.58 meters.
Wow, yes. The woman's amount is bigger than the men.
Next one. So still 3-2. What about first? So Indonesia is first for something in the world. What is it?
I don't know. First country having Pancasila?
The first country...
having Pancasila.
What's that?
Pancasila is like the...
What's that?
If you can explain it, I might give you a point.
Oh my God. Pancasila is like
Actually, we are the democracy, but we have like our own system.
Philosophy,
yeah, like a philosophy.
It's like a philosophy. Okay.
So we have the symbol of Garuda.
It's definitely not gonna be that.
I don't think it's gonna be that. What about you, Del?
It's the world's most populous Islamic nation. It's the first number one.
I have the what's that?
But you can't.
Indonesia has many islands.
Okay. Quite possibly. The one I was looking for is actually the first. Largest Islamic country, populous country in the world. Okay? So 3-3.
Okay.
What about 8? 8, was it volcanoes?
8 lands.
Lands. 8 World Heritage sites.
8 lands.
I think there are a lot more than that, but...
the main lands.
I'm looking for... Go on, what are they? What are the main islands? The main lands?
Yeah.
Sumatra.
Kalimantan,
Sulawesi, Papua, Nusa Tenggara,
Flores,
Komodo, Bali.
I think there are a lot more than 8 actually.
Oh, yeah.
The answer I'm looking for is World Heritage Sites.
Oh god.
So 4-3. And the
really
last one.
Eight? What are they?
Oh, you tell me.
Really? I asked you. Okay. Why? What are they? Yeah?
To the last question.
Yeah.
5,120.
Mountain.
You're going for mountains?
Yes.
No idea. I got nothing.
You're going for mountains.
Languages.
Actually, it was in kilometers, so it's actually from east to west. I think that we talked about yesterday, it's as long... It's like London to Tehran in Iran. You're a very long country.
So does that mean I win?
Yeah, you are!
Del has beaten the locals.
Wow! are not Indonesian.